Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And this week, LSD, magic mushrooms, DMT. Most people think of these mind-altering drugs as recreational, experimental, and maybe even dangerous. But not as potential medicines, or at least not anymore. In fact, LSD, or lysergic acid dithalamide, to give it its full name, was first created by Albert Hofmann in 1938, whilst trying to make a medical drug that would stimulate the respiratory and circulatory system. In that respect, it was considered useless. And it wasn't until he accidentally ingested some in 1943 that its hallucinogenic properties were discovered. There was then a flurry of research throughout the 40s, 50s and 60s. Psychiatrists gave it to their patients to help recall repressed thoughts. The military experimented with how it disrupted the orders and plannings of different soldiers. And army intelligence tried to use it as a truth serum. However, it became banned in 1966 as governments protested its widespread use and popularity among the population, and research then ceased. Joining me today is the first scientist to do a brain imaging study with LSD and one of the first researchers to test it on humans in over 40 years, Dr. Robin Carhart-Harris from Imperial College University. His pioneering research looks at how the brain changes on LSD and what we can learn about consciousness, as well as LSD's potential therapeutic benefits for treating depression. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, how hard was it to get permission to do this research?
It is especially difficult. You need all the usual ethical permissions and institutional approvals, and the stigma that can hang over this category of drugs can make that quite difficult. And sometimes the opposition isn't always sort of openly declared. It's sort of implicit almost, and that can slow things and obstruct things. Also, we need approval from the government. We need a Home Office license to store, handle and administer the drug. So these things take time. They cost a little bit of money as well, and that can put people off. All these things together make it particularly difficult to do, but it's worth it.
Definitely. And we're going to be hearing more about what you have discovered. But first, just a disclaimer that LSD is a Class A drug. So we are not advocating that you try it at home. That doesn't mean the science isn't fascinating, though. And for our experiment today, we'll be looking at suggestibility. So I suggest you get a partner, a stopwatch and a ruler. But now over to producer Yaz with our weekly brain teaser.
So this morning's brain teaser, and you'll see the relevance of this at the end of the show, is what kind of room has no windows or doors, or what's the only room you can never enter or leave? So if you think you know the answer, you can tweet at us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio.
Indeed you can.
It's got me puzzled.
Now, Robin, what is your first song of the mixtape?
So it's a gentle start, and I went with Elbow, Scattered Black and Whites.
Why did you choose this one?
I find it quite a moving track. It's one of the few, I suppose, that could potentially move me to tears. It's reflective, it's about childhood, it makes me think about my own childhood and being surrounded, you know, by love and loving family members. He talks about his granddad. It makes me think of mine. And we'll see perhaps the relevance in terms of psychedelics is really around them being able to reveal to us aspects of our minds that perhaps we're not fully conscious of, perhaps aspects of our histories that we've forgotten, and it has this curious way of lifting these past experiences back into consciousness. Sometimes that can be difficult, but sometimes it can have quite a profound therapeutic effect as well. So that's the theme, really.
been climbing trees, I've skinned my knees, my hands are black, the sun is going down. She scruffs my hair in the kitchen steam, she's listening to the dream I weave today.
Psychedelic was coined by British psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond in the 1950s. It combines two Greek words, psyche, which means mind or soul, and delos, to reveal. So literally, to reveal the soul.
I think that's so cool. I didn't know that before researching the show. Like, Robin, as you said at the top, it's really difficult to get permission to do this research. And as I said, not many people would think of the scientific potential of these drugs. So what was it that inspired you or got you interested in doing this in the first place?
Well, academically, it was becoming fascinated by the mind. I suppose on a personal level, wanting to understand myself, and then being drawn into psychology, and being especially fascinated by depth psychology. And by that, I mean psychoanalysis specifically. I was fascinated by reading Freud. For me, reading Freud was an experience more than something cognitive or even intellectual. Again, I was quite moved by what he was saying, shocked, and
when his ideas of sort of the mind having different compartments.
Yes, and things around the Oedipus complex and, parental dynamics and...
how your experiences kind of shape you and...
Yes, yeah. I was shocked and sort of frightened, actually, by the ideas, but I couldn't put them away, you know. And I know a lot of people sort of readily sort of reject Freud, but it had such a deep resonance with me that I had to listen to it, you know, and then studying psychoanalysis after my degree for a master's, I came across literature on the use of LSD in psychotherapy, and specifically psychoanalytic psychotherapy, the rationale being that it dissolves the ego and then facilitates access to unconscious material, and this just really struck a chord for me, and I thought...
For anyone who doesn't know, would you mind just explaining, like, what the ego is and why it would be important to dissolve it?
Well, not always. I mean, the ego might serve a important functions, you know, in terms of why we have egos, why we have a sense of self that we...
'Cause it's not the same as the kind of colloquial use of if someone has an ego, they're really big-headed, is it? It's more of...
It's broader than that, really. Yeah. The ego means I,
okay.
Fundamentally. In German, it was das Ich, you know, the I. And so it's your sense of self. It's Matilda, it's Robin, you know, it's your understanding of who you are, and obviously, you know, others feed into that and build this narrative of who you are. The colloquial sense is still relevant because, you know, you can overinflate your ego and invest too much in it and your own sense of self-importance. So, and also the ego can be defensive, you know, it tries to protect itself. But these defenses can sometimes be counterproductive and lead to suffering, mental suffering.
Would that be a kind of like suppressing memories and things that would be like a defensive?
Yes, yeah, all sorts of kind of defense mechanisms.
And so you thought that this would be a way to sort of reveal the unconscious mind?
Yeah, inspired by people writing about that. And really the angle that I wanted to go at this with was one of neuroscience. I wanted to understand the biology of these ideas, psychoanalytic ideas. You know, where's the ego in the brain? Where's the unconscious mind? What is it? What is repression? You know, and I, you know, still believe and think we've made some inroads with respect to identifying these things.
What did you find?
Oh, well, if we focus on the ego, mm-hmm. we've based on other literature, but also based on our work with psychedelic drugs, psilocybin, magic mushrooms, and also LSD, we've identified a particular network in the brain, which is arguably the strongest candidate for a neural substrate, if you want, of the sense of self or ego. And we found that this network, known as the default mode network, appears to dissolve or disintegrate under the effects of psychedelics. And this effect correlates with people's reports of ego dissolution.
And is that, when you say reports of ego dissolution, is that the feeling that you're connected to everything?
Yes, it's very much related. In fact, the two things are synonymous, really. When the ego dissolves, what accompanies that is a feeling of oneness, you know, that kind of thing that you would attribute to sort of hippie speak, you know, we're all one, you know.
But it really does seem to be like a kind of neuro element of that. That's really cool.
Yeah, we've got, you know, some hypotheses about that. Mm. I guess it's too early to say it's established, but I think we've got some important leads on that.
And in your brain scans, I think I've seen you say that you found the brain was kind of hyper-connected when someone was kind of taking LSD and tripping.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about that, what you think that kind of means?
Yeah, well, we're just learning, but that's one of the effects that seems to correlate with ego dissolution. So you could describe it as a global connectivity in the brain. So you have modules or systems in the brain that are normally quite separate from each other, quite segregated from each other. And they kind of need to be because they subserve different functions. And so they have, they give us and they give the brain and the mind some specialization so that it can do...
Like the visual part or the language part.
Exactly. But what you see under psychedelics is that these different modules now start talking to each other much more. And if you look at the big picture, the whole of the brain, it's much more interconnected. It's communicating much more freely. And this effect did correlate with ego dissolution. And as a sort of working hypothesis, we're putting forward the idea that it may relate to this sense of oneness. The globally connected brain is related to a feeling of being globally connected, if you want.
Wow. And is that similar to how the brain looks when you're dreaming? Because people describe the kind of psychedelic hallucinations as dreamlike.
There might be other circuits that are more relevant in that context, actually, in terms of the visual aspect of dreaming and the visual aspect of psychedelics. But what it is related to is the early brain, so early in development. So if we think about an infant's brain and we think about the psychology of being an infant and not really knowing that you exist, that you're separate from other people. And so, you know, there's quite a clear link there, I think.
So that's so cool. So an infant's brain, I guess, it hasn't really become specialised yet, has it?
No.
And you're seeing the brain revert to that kind of state.
Yeah, it kind of regresses back to that infantile state. And, you know, people have talked in a poetic way, Wordsworth and such like, about infants being in a sort of spiritual state, closer to God. I think maybe Jesus might have said something about children being closer to God, you know. But then babies aren't that sophisticated in other senses. So, you know, this is one of the things about the brain and the mind, is there are trade-offs here and there, you know.
What's your second song?
Oh, yeah, so I think we're going with Left Field, Storm 3000, from their classic album Leftism. So we're going into the banging tunes now, and it doesn't have any lyrics, but I just love the track and always have, really. And the title, I think, is really powerful, Storm 3000. It makes me think of what could happen if we perhaps continue on our current trajectory, harming the world that we live in, and what kind of, you know, environment we would exist in, you know, in the year 3000.
Psychotropic effects of LSD were discovered by accident in 1943. Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann had created the substance in 1938, but didn't realise its effects until 5 years later when he unintentionally ingested some.
I was just thinking while that song was playing what you were saying about the brain being more connected, and that totally explains why people seem to feel like they can be more creative or, you know, are inspired for their art or something when they've taken it.
Absolutely, yeah, novel connections and... you know, seeing the bigger picture is something that might follow from that.
Now, we're going to look at one part of your experimentation, which has been suggestibility. And you've discovered that people are more suggestible when they're tripping. Tell me about this. What is suggestibility?
It's really sensitivity to suggestion. It might be something that perhaps, in terms of why we have an ego, it might be something that the ego is a kind of counterforce to, that the ego allows us to be perhaps more discerning and more critical in our thinking, more analytical, and perhaps less easily influenced even, and perhaps less easily tricked, you know, if you think about... things in an evolutionary sense. So, you know, it's not, the ego isn't all bad. It may serve our own survival as individuals well to an extent, but, you know, like I was saying earlier, there are always trade-offs here. And so, you know, if you lower the ego, perhaps you can more easily become immersed in stimuli. And suggestibility is related to that, really, to become immersed in someone else's kind of commands and leads, you know.
Is it something that varies generally in the population anyway?
It is, yeah. And it's related to things like hypnotizability.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so very much related, and a lot of people would say that that's what hypnosis is. It's susceptibility to suggestion. So
talk me through, what are we going to be doing today?
Okay, so in one of our studies with LSD, we had our volunteers listen to me reading a suggestibility script, and you can do things like look at their... imagery, you can induce mental imagery with these scripts, but you can also invite and encourage people to do things. So, you know, to perhaps sway their body or move their arm. And that's, I think, what we're going to do here. So if it works,
I will be your willing subject. Sure. And listeners at home, like, definitely join in. I think all you need is to be able to listen to Robin's voice, right?
Yeah, I think so. You don't need to drop any acid. Okay, so here we go. So if you hold out your right arm.
And are my eyes open? Or
close your eyes.
Close my eyes, yeah, okay. I'm holding out.
You'll be able to immerse into it easier. Hold your right arm straight out in front of you. At shoulder height and parallel to the floor, and concentrate on your arm and listen to me. Imagine that your right arm is feeling heavier and heavier, that it is moving down and down. It's becoming heavier and heavier and moving down and down. It weighs a ton. It's getting heavier and heavier. It's moving down and down, more and more, coming down and down, more and more. It's heavier, coming down, more and more. You can relax your arm now. So then you score how much you lowered your arm. So there's different variations of this. You can describe that heavy books are being placed on your flat hand in front of you and measure how much people's arms go down. Anyway, so we did something very similar to this in the LSD study and actually found that people did move their arms much lower down under the LSD. Yeah.
Do you want to know which one of you lowered your hand the most?
Yeah, so listeners, I should have said Kyle is also here in the studio today, so we had two of us taking part. And I have no idea how much mine moved down. It was weird. I felt like it was kind of moving. Yeah. And I was trying consciously not to move it at all, so I wasn't trying to move it back up. But I could feel like a slight air current, like it was maybe moving, and it did feel kind of heavy. Yeah,
I feel like mine moved down quite a lot. I think I probably dropped about, I don't know, 20, 30 centimetres, something like that.
Yeah, I would say that you dropped your hand way more than Matilda did. So
really?
You've got a
really
strong ego there.
Actually, once, when I was on holiday once, someone did say, oh, I'm a hypnotist. And I was like, oh, I've never experienced it. And he did a couple of like tests, which sound a bit like the suggestibility test, like imagining my hands were stuck together and could I pull them apart. And then he told me I'd failed and I couldn't be hypnotized. So maybe I'm just not very suggestible.
Yeah. Well, we're all different.
Yeah. Oh, well. why do you think that it's an important aspect of the experience that people become suggestible?
Well, it sort of feeds into the potential therapeutic application of psychedelics. Part of the therapeutic process actually is your willingness to listen to the therapist, to acknowledge and what they're saying, and also in the psychedelic therapeutic model, typically people listen to music actually. So they lie down with eye shades on, they have headphones on, and they listen to a music playlist. You know, it could be relaxing tunes or emotionally evocative classical music, for example. And if you're more susceptible to becoming immersed in that stimulus, then that can have a more greater therapeutic effect.
Brilliant, and that's what we're going to be talking about in the next section. So, what is your third song?
So I have a tune by William Orbit, and it's. It's called Water from a Vine Leaf, and it's a particular mix, the Xylem Flow mix, that I kind of fell in love with through a particular album that I would play over and over in my bedroom, just becoming deeply immersed in it, you know, late at night, perhaps coming in after being out with some friends in my sort of mid to late teens, and just becoming really immersed in this mix, and this was one of the tracks that really stood out.
Was initially called melancholia. The earliest accounts of melancholia appeared in ancient Mesopotamian texts in the 2nd millennium BC. At this time, all mental illnesses were thought to be caused when somebody was taken over by demons.
Robin, you started to talk about the therapeutic potentials of psychedelic drugs. What exactly, could you tell us exactly the kind of the research you've been doing into psilocybin and depression?
Yeah, sure. So we looked at psilocybin in treatment-resistant depression. Patients who had tried a range of different treatments that hadn't worked. So, you know, your Prozac-type antidepressants, they tried at least two different varieties. Some had used as many as 11 and they hadn't worked for them. And many of the patients had had their depressions, they would say, since adolescence. And so they're stuck, you know, and they're suffering for so long. And the thing about depression is it often takes people kind of out of the world, if you want. There's this withdrawal, and it's associated with not turning up to work, for example. And when you do turn up, you can't engage because...
It's like a loss of feeling and a loss of pleasure, like you can't take pleasure in anything
That's
anymore.
Right, yeah, anhedonia. And so, you know, nothing really gives you the same... it's harder to engage and the world's kind of drained of colour. So we gave psilocybin, two doses, one of which was quite high, 25 milligrams, to these patients, 20 patients, and two sessions a week apart. And they did, as I was describing earlier, lie down with eye shades on and listen to some music. And then they have supportive people around them, a couple of people, psychiatrists usually, who are there to listen to whatever they tell them, really, and describe. But generally, it's quite hands-off, and really the patient has quite an immersive experience with the music and is taken on a journey with that and whatever is in their own minds. And they often experience insights. They report experiencing insights about their lives, decisions they've made, relationships they've had, and they often report a sense of clarity. There can be it can be quite difficult and challenging and dysphoric at times as well, quite dark. But that when there's an overcoming of that, then it can be transformative.
How long do the sessions last? Like, how long is the experience?
Yeah, it's about 5-6 hours long.
Oh, wow.
So it's a long playlist. But they time kind of goes out the window in a way. It's like a sort of warp zone. they experience so much. And what's really amazing with these compounds is that you can have these isolated experiences that last for just a few hours, and they can change your life, you know, potentially forever. Change you, change your outlook in quite a fundamental way. And
can you give some examples?
Gosh. I think people describe a sense of, and this is something that I've been looking at with a colleague of mine, Rosalind Watts, who's a clinical psychologist, but people describe a sense of reconnection. So they might describe during the experience itself as a sense of a oneness, but this sense of reconnection to themselves, deeper aspects of themselves, a reconnection to other people, a reconnection to the world, so that the colour comes back, you know, is something that's very characteristic. Another aspect of it really is you could liken it to what's called the overview effect, mm-hmm. That astronauts describe when they come back from, you know, being
having out, looked down on Earth.
Yeah, having looked down on Earth and realizing our own insignificance as individuals, and that there's this big, you know, world that's very vulnerable there, and it allows you to literally see the bigger picture and realize how precious this world, this space is, and how we should care about it. And so coming back to Earth, they often feel like a renewed sense of purpose and meaning, and they might change their, you know, outlook and philosophy on life and even political perspective and be more egalitarian and altruistic in their perspectives.
And how, like, what kind of effects did you find in the patients that did your trial? Was it long lasting? I mean, was it kind of 100% success rate? What did you find?
Actually, for the first week, it was 100% in that everyone showed some degree of reduction, but there were different magnitudes in that reduction. Some patients went straight into remission, so you know they didn't have depression anymore, which was quite remarkable, given that
straight into remission.
Oh yes, wow. Yeah, and that lasted in half of the patients for 3 weeks, which was pretty amazing. Yeah. You know, again, if you think of all the other treatments that they'd thrown at their depression. You know, the effects wear off and come 3 months, 6 months, we're seeing some patients relapse. And then because psilocybin isn't legally available, and this was a clinical trial, they'll go to their doctor and you know, what's available for them is the usual,
serotonin reuptake.
Yeah, the Prozac-like drugs and psychotherapy is just... hard to get, and sometimes it's brief and just feels a bit too shallow and doesn't really get to the core. And that's something, again, that's really different about the psychedelic treatment, is that patients will say, this got to the source, you know, and everything else was just palliative. It was just reducing the symptoms in a way that allowed me to manage, but it didn't really get to the core like psychedelics can.
Wow. And do you think it's to do with, like, making the mind more connected? Because I know people have spoken before about patterns of anxiety, and you get kind of stuck in a cycle of things triggering your response and you can't break out of it. And do you think this was a way to kind of break some of those patterns?
I think so. You know, an important thing to emphasize is that we give the drug in a particular way, you know, and so we prepare the patients for the experience. We provide them with this very supportive environment and supportive people around them that are there to listen, and so we give them time to talk and space, and then we provide the possibility, the opportunity to integrate what they may have learnt during the experience, and so that kind of model, I think, really facilitates the reconnection. The alternative is that, you know, someone could take some acid and go, you know, to a rave or something, and they don't necessarily feel that connection because too much is going on and they don't have the right people there willing to listen and help them, and it can take,
and they're not going on the internal journey.
No, because there's this, you know, sensory overload outside, so you know, it's something, this class of drugs, you know, they need to be treated with the utmost respect, really.
I think in the public, you know, there's this LSD is a kind of scary drug, or like mushrooms, there, because people have these bad trips, they have experiences that are negative, and obviously you obviously have to take steps to ensure that doesn't happen when you're doing it in a research context.
Yeah. In a way, it's good that people are scared, you know, but the important thing is that, you know, for example, in the therapy, we don't talk about bad trips, we talk about challenging experiences. And if you can go into the challenge and try and, you know, look your demons in the eye, then you can potentially break through and come out the other side transformed in a positive way.
That's a really nice way to look at it. And I know that there's been like research into some other kind of illegal drugs, like MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. I thought that was a really interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, slightly different model. It's about allowing you to go there, as in go to the trauma, the difficult place, more easily, that you're not necessarily overwhelmed by the anxiety and panic. In PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, patients might dissociate because it's just too overwhelming to go there. But MDMA can make it a bit easier. And again, those themes of...
More open to kind of just talking, I suppose.
Yeah, and feeling like, you know, the therapists that are there with you are very caring, and that sense of connection and love that can really be felt with MDMA.
So MDMA is ecstasy, right? That's what it's like, yeah. The street name of that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that this, your research, will be kind of developed further and one day in the future maybe like used properly in therapeutic ways?
I think so. The important thing is to go slow and steady at the moment and not try to claim too much. Just do the science and try and do it well. Certainly it's really taking off at the moment. We just need to keep our feet on the ground and do our best and then be led by the data. But you know, looking into the future, I am confident actually that eventually this will come to patients as a licensed therapeutic model, because I think it works, and I think it works in a particular way that at the moment we don't really have treatments that can do this. Yeah.
Wow. On that note, what is song number four?
Oh, song number four. Next two tracks are kind of sort of relevant, I suppose, to the therapeutic theme. And Underworld, I needed to include a track by Underworld because they've in a way sort of been a soundtrack to you know, sort of coming of age sort of time in my life. And I was going to go with Dark and Long, and I chopped and changed, but Dirty Epic is the tune I'll go with by Underworld.
In a big screen satellite, disappearing down the tube hole at Farringdon Street, with Whiplash Willie the motorcycle.
Moonlight, it burns my eyes. Moonlight, it burns my eyes.
Early experiments with animals found that mice given LSD moved erratically and showed alterations in licking behaviour. Cats' hair stood on end and they salivated, indicating they were having hallucinations that were threatening or enticing. Aquarium fish swam oddly and spiders altered web-building patterns.
News just in. A 100-year-old imaging technique for the womb has been helping to cure infertility all this time.
Even short-term opioid use can risk addiction.
Nazis on drugs.
Limitless blood supplies are tantalizing close to becoming reality.
A wearable robot could prevent vulnerable people from falling.
Tell me more about your wearable robot, Yaz.
Okay, so wearable robots are the future, maybe, we can see. But this is a exoskeleton that you can wear around your hips and waist, and it packs motors into the user's hips. So the motors can sense sort of blips in balance. So if somebody's about to fall, it can correct them automatically before they actually fall and hurt themselves. So this has got great potential to help people who have had strokes, or older people who are maybe, you know, a little bit wobbly on their feet. It can actually stop you falling in the first place, which is pretty amazing.
Is it? I'm imagining, like, is it quite kind of bulky?
At the moment, it's very bulky, but the potential of these things to, you know, improve and scale down in size is pretty amazing. So that in the future, you could even be wearing something under your clothes that allows you to walk around freely without the worry of falling, which is pretty cool.
So cool. So my story this week was about this 100-year-old imaging technique. Apparently this professor, Ben Moll, his mum once told him that this medical imaging technique where they flush poppy seed oil through the fallopian tubes of the uterus in order to kind of pick them up on x-rays was what had cured her infertility and led to his birth. And he became really curious and actually did some proper research and found that in a test of more than 1,000 infertile women, flushing the fallopian tubes with this poppy seed oil allowed 40% of them to become naturally pregnant within 6 months.
Wow.
Which, considering the cost of IVF, is an amazing kind of discovery. And now, Robin, you have brought us our very first science mixtape book review news. So please take it away. Tell us about these Nazis on methamphetamines.
Yeah, okay. So this is a book that was published last year by a German author, Norman Ohler. The title of the English publication of the book is Blitzed. And basically the thesis is evidence-based thesis, is that there was a systematic administration of methamphetamine to the Nazis, certainly early in the war. And the claim is made that, you know, the notion of blitzkrieg was kind of founded on methamphetamine and the speed and rate at which the Nazis were able to invade and conquer France could actually be put down to the fact that they just didn't stop. They were incessant and they didn't sleep. And the speed of it was related to them literally being on speed, you know.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and it's quite a compelling idea. And I find it really interesting because it's something that perhaps hasn't been properly looked into and is perhaps, you know, really important and underappreciated, is how drugs can influence our behavior in such a way that it has political implications, you know.
Definitely. And I know inside of my introduction that the Ministry of Defense in America was kind of looking into using LSD as almost as a weapon. That they were thinking of putting it in bombs and then like shelling the enemy, and then the LSD would kind of, I don't know, somehow infect the soldiers and they would all just start tripping rather than following their instructions. Which,
yeah, you wouldn't feel like fighting after that.
Yeah, but I also don't think you'd want to be having hallucinations while things are exploding around you.
Oh, God, no. They did try something like that, actually, in a village in France and dropped some, I think it was LSD. And, yeah, people, you know, as you would expect, went kind of mad. Yeah, and actually the Nazis sort of started some of this in some sense, and the Americans were kind of inspired by some of this research they were doing. The Nazis were looking at mescaline as a sort of brainwashing tool. Mescaline's another psychedelic, and
like brainwashing.
Yeah, that's... and so the CIA kind of took up this line of inquiry in the 50s and looked at LSD in a similar kind of mind control sort of context.
Fascinating. Yeah. What is your fifth song?
Oh, yes. Okay. So sticking on the kind of therapy theme, this is one of my favorite songs of all time. It's Ceremony by New Order, where actually it was written by Joy Division before Ian Curtis committed suicide. Well, for a start, it's a great track. It's very deep. The lyrics are quite ambiguous, and in a way that's part of the appeal. I've always found it quite euphoric, and I read a little review of it online that described it as a small piece of sonic catharsis, and I thought, that's it, you know, that's beautiful. And given the context of losing the lead singer and then coming back as this band that went on to such success, sort of fits a theme of sort of catharsis and rebirth, you know.
This is why it's so lovely. They find it all a different story. No sinful wheels are turning. Turn again and turn towards this time. All she asks is strength to hold me. Then again the same old story.
Psychologists say that few things can truly alter someone's personality in adulthood, but magic mushrooms may be one of those things. A 2011 study found that after one dose of psilocybin, people became more open to new experiences for at least 14 months, a shockingly stable change.
That's exactly what you were saying before, isn't it, Robin? How this can be the experience of a lifetime and really change your outlook on things.
Yeah, and it's something that we're keen to look into more in the future, this relationship between becoming more open, but how that relates to how we change our outlook and perspective and sort of philosophy on life, even potentially change our political perspective, becoming perhaps more... more questioning, more open, more tolerant, you know, maybe more liberal. And so we've been testing that and actually finding that that prediction is endorsed by the data, that people seem to become certainly more open, but also more liberal and less authoritarian in their views, more questioning, but in a healthy way, I think, you know.
That's so interesting. So would you say that's what's next for your research?
Yeah, that's part of it. Also, to look more at the therapeutic application, we're going to compare psilocybin with a Prozac-like drug, go head-to-head, look at how these drugs work differently in the brain and how they work differently psychologically. And so I'm really excited about that particular trial.
It's going to be fascinating. Yaz, have we had any answers to the brain teaser?
Yeah, thank you everyone who tweeted in with your answers. Elocha has said, probably not a physical room, but that's as far as my brain can go today. I guess it is still quite early for a brain teaser. But the actual answer to the brain teaser was guessed correctly by Lucy, and it is mushroom. A mushroom is the kind of room that you can't enter or leave.
See how we linked it into the show?
Very good.
Yeah. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolutely fascinating journey of exploration. I've learned so much. I wish you all the luck, best luck with your research.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
What is your final song to play us out with?
It's a Prodigy. I had to include Prodigy. You'll probably have noticed there's lots of dance music here. In a way, I think, you know, my interest in music and dance music particularly, it's kind of influenced, you know, where I've gone in my career, in becoming interested in drugs and states. And Prodigy were one of the earliest acts that really inspired me and got me interested in music. My older brother bought the album Experience, and then I became a bit of a bedroom raver, and eventually became a literal adult raver. But and this is just a banging tune that that people should turn up their radios and get raving to. It's Prodigy, One Love.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world. Science.